the more I hear about this person, I feel like her name is Karen and she wants to talk to my manager, like, you know, to tell me a thing or two about how I need to get better at life. Hey, folks, and welcome to Everything That Rises, a podcast about the short stories of the one and only Flannery O'Connor. My name is John Meehan. I'm an English teacher based out of Arlington, Virginia, even though I am a Yankee by trade, a Northerner by birth. And today we're taking a look at Flannery O'Connor's short story, Revelation. And to do so, I've invited a great friend and an awesome teacher to join the podcast. Do you want to say hi and introduce yourself?
Sure. Hello, everyone. My name is Victoria Benuti, and I am a teacher also in Northern Virginia alongside John Meehan.
Woo woo. Sorry.
Boop boop. Yeah.
You've been teaching for how long, Victoria?
This is year five. This is year five.
Awesome. And you currently, because it bears pointing out for the sake of this podcast, you have taught in two schools, but they both have something in common in that they are both
Catholic, private Catholic schools. Ooh, yep. Right. Of different sorts. It's great. Previous school I taught at was a small Catholic school, grades 7 to 12, and now I'm at a larger diocesan high school only. So, yeah.
It's different. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think it's important. It bears noting that the Catholic piece does play a factor in getting to know a little bit about us as educators, because,
absolutely,
spoiler, Flannery O'Connor is really Catholic. So it helps to have a little bit of a background, at least in Christian understanding. You don't have to be Catholic to understand her, but I think it certainly doesn't hurt. Real quick, before we get into anything, Victoria, on the Twitter machine, I'm Meehan EDU. That's like my last name, EDU. Is there a way that folks can find you on social media or on Twitter?
Absolutely. And this quarantine has given me an excellent opportunity to jumpstart my social media presence again. Since,
yeah, girl, let's
I'd
go.
Lag behind, I know. So I'm pretty sure I'm at Miss B DJO, but let me double check on that, because
okay, good deal.
It's DJ been a little while. I don't have my Twitter handle memorized.
The days are leading together, all that stuff. The DJO stands for Dennis J O'Connell, where we currently teach. But I'm realizing you're currently Miss B DJO. And very quickly, you actually have a very important life event coming up, so your Twitter handle might change.
Exactly, I know. I've been coming up with all different sorts of things. I've been Miss B for 5 years, and now I'll have to,
Well, here we go. We both are, and double check me if that Twitter handle is wrong, but both of us as educators in a Catholic school, both of us as English teachers in a Catholic school, Flannery O'Connor is, I mean, for me, like one of the undiscovered gems of American literature. I think that she's amazing. I teach a lot of American literature. I've taught American literature for 10 years now. I went to school for an English major and I stayed one for my master's. And we never really got exposed to more than one or two of her pieces, which to me is a major oversight, because I think that she's really, really good. But I'm biased because it's my podcast, so I should probably shut up. Your thoughts in general about Flannery O'Connor and whether or not you believe the hype on that, or if there's more to that story.
Oh no, Flannery O'Connor absolutely is, I think, one of the best modern American authors. And I was introduced to Flannery O'Connor in undergrad. I actually first encountered her through her letters, interestingly enough, her letters and essays. I was taking a teaching writing class, and our instructor had assigned us one of her essays. I think it's Teaching in the Eighth Grade. It's Something in the Eighth Grade is the name of the essay.
Okay.
And I so enjoyed her wit and her spunk and her personality that I'm like, I have to read more by this woman. So I ended up reading more of her essays and short stories, and just found a lot that resonated with me and also challenged me as an aspiring educator.
Love it.
And then later on, got to know her through her short stories. So.
Amazing. So I have I have eight questions before we get into this. The essay, I'm real-time fact-checking us, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Go for it.
It's called Total Effect with an E and the Eighth Grade.
There we go. Yep.
63 essay, Total Effect and the Eighth Grade by Flannery O'Connor. You mentioned you were first exposed to her as an undergraduate. Where did you go to undergraduate?
Undergrad was at Franciscan University in Steubenville, Ohio. Whoop whoop.
So that's a whoop whoop big Catholic school for sure. Like Catholic is part of its deal. It's in its DNA, correct?
Definitely. And speaking of Catholic schools, we also have another Catholic school in common, aside from the one we currently teach at.
Yeah, we do. We both went to the same college for our master's degree.
That's right.
We didn't know each other then. I think I'm old. But we did both go to the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. So that was my first exposure to Flannery O'Connor. I think as a public school kid, I maybe was neglected or abandoned the chance to engage with her stuff. But it's so good. I mean, I teach modernism. I teach, you know, relativism. I teach existential stuff. Mm-hmm. Talk about Their Eyes Are Watching God. Talk about The Great Gatsby, T.S. Eliot. And it's all in the same oeuvre of like the 19-teens, 20s, 30s, and like 40s and 50s of when they're reshaping the fabric of what the belief system of the country is. Like, how can you not talk about these really powerful, really great authors and like these female voices like Flannery O'Connor? She does so much. Huge fan. I think I've made that abundantly clear. But let's get into it. So we're talking today about one of her short stories. Flannery O'Connor did write 32 short stories. So if this podcast has a life cycle, we hope to talk about every one of those friggin' stories over the course of maybe 32 weeks, maybe more. We might spend some multiple episodes. And she's an essayist, a writer, a novelist, but she's most known for her short stories for sure. In the time of the Southern Gothic, and she lived in the 1920s through 1964. She has a very devout, I'll call it a Vatican I Catholicism. Would you agree with that, Victoria?
Yep. She kept her Summa by her bedside.
Yeah. So for those who are not initiated, the Summa is a great literary text of religious import. That was by St. Thomas Aquinas. Did I get that one right, Victoria?
Yep.
Awesome. And it's called the Summa Theologica. We like to joke that it is the Sumo Theologica because it's a really fat book about how to be a Catholic.
I hadn't heard that one before. That's great.
I think Flannery O'Connor would appreciate it too, because she's actually, though she herself struggled with lupus, she spent her whole life kind of dealing with a chronic illness that she knew would ultimately take her life. She does a lot of body shaming. I think it's important when we talk about tall and skinny and fat. I think she kind of leads with that in most of her stories. And, a lot of female maiden characters, a lot of ugly characters, a lot of ableism we have to kind of joke about or make fun of, because she has a really dark sense of humor. So the story we're talking about today is the story called Revelation. And Victoria, you had picked this one, so I'm going to let you kind of tee it up for the audience. Can you talk about just like a overview at 20,000 feet? What is the plot summary of this very short story called Revelation by Flannery O'Connor?
Sure. So our story first opens in a doctor's waiting room.
Yes.
Interesting to think about nowadays. Mm-hmm. It'd be rather empty. So doctor's waiting room, and we have a few personages assembled that are, as you can imagine, characterized in all sorts of ways, mostly physically, but also through the interior thoughts of our main character, Mrs. Turpin. And as our Go for it.
And we have to point out, like, the story is technically told from an omniscience point of view, which, again, like, this is an English teacher geek out, right? An omniscient, someone who can see everything. But the omniscient clearly is rooting for Mrs. Turpin when it's telling the story. It's seeing it kind of with her slant or her stink on everything in the room. Is that fair?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, got it. Sorry, yep, so I totally interrupted.
No worries. Ahead. We're getting this filtered. We're essentially panning around this doctor's room by getting it filtered through the eyes of Mrs. Turpin. And as our story proceeds, Mrs. Turpin has got her eye on this college-age girl, and the college-age girl has her eye on Mrs. Turpin, and there's something going on. But eventually, we'll get into it. I don't know if you want the spoiler now, because it's one of the best parts of the story.
Yeah,
but,
something happens.
Something comes up in the air. And creates a conflict in which spirals Mrs. Turpin into this whole string of reflection when she heads home for the evening. So then we shift gears from the doctor's office back to Mrs. Turpin's home out in the countryside. And eventually in the evening, she's heading out to take care of the pigs. And
because why not, right? Spoiler, it's going to involve animals, it's going to involve caring for the land, it's going to involve Flannery O'Connor always says that she doesn't know that the South is Christ influenced, but it is Christ haunted. And she has like this idea of a haunting, like, specter of faith that's everywhere. And I think that's super, super cool, because there's a lot of Jesus in the air, Lord Jesus. And we have to talk about that too. But I'm sorry, this end of the story where she's taking care of the pigs. Go ahead.
Yep. So at this, there's this, it's all building up the setting, the pigs there, what she's thinking, who she's talking to. And eventually it builds into this, this grand revelation. A revelation. At the end.
I like it. So that's a spoiler-free look at it here. Let's dive deep into it. You've taught this story before to a high school audience?
Yes. So previous school, I taught sophomore American literature. So this was one of the, I think, highlights of the year. I love teaching this story to high schoolers because I think there's so much in there to enjoy.
There is. And if they don't get it or they're just looking at you the wrong way, do you ever just feel tempted to throw the book at them? No?
Yeah. Yeah. Except I would probably get fired for that.
That's fair, but you don't work there anymore. No, but talking about throwing the book, it's a exactly. teachable moment because it's out of the story.
Yep,
so,
yep.
I mean, Flannery O'Connor is not subtle when it comes to symbolism. And I guess we can kind of go deeper into it. So this is your last spoiler warning. If you know nothing about the story, if you're a high school student who's listening, this is the one that's going to do more than plot summary and dive deep into some thematic analysis and some symbolism. Basically, all that stuff that English teachers do and get together and say, oh, what that really represented was blah, 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 blah. And maybe I should ask that question to you before we go any further, Ms. Minuti. Have you seen that meme that says what your English teacher thought it meant and what the author actually meant? The Venn diagram that overlaps about, like, the blue curtains represent the tragedy and the disparate, you know, the sadness of their soul. And the author's like, no, they were just blue curtains. I don't know what you're talking about.
I don't think I've seen the meme, but I can visualize it.
Okay,
yeah,
got it.
That's great.
Do you think we can read too far into a short story, particularly a short story by an author like Flannery O'Connor?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's so much room for interpretation, whether that's over interpretation or not. But I think that one of the reasons that I love teaching this particular short story is because the symbolism is just right there in your face, smacking you on the nose.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I was saying before I went live on a podcast, I don't think you have to be Catholic to understand Flannery O'Connor. But I do think to understand Flannery O'Connor is to become more Catholic in some ways, because, like, you don't have to agree with what she's saying, but it helps you kind of contextualize the world in where she was raised, which is there aren't as many folks who are Catholic in Georgia as there are folks who are Southern Baptists or people who are in you know, ecumenical Christian groups. But for Flannery O'Connor, it's pretty unrelentingly, like, it's the church, it's very capital C Catholicism. Like, there's not a lot of wiggle room about the way that she sees faith. Is that a fair assessment?
I'd say so. Yeah. Okay.
Well, let's dig deep in some of the symbolism. So to dive into it to begin with, we begin the story in a doctor's office. I don't think that's an accident. And we meet our main character. Her name is Mrs. Turpin. When I see names immediately, I think about, like, Charles Dickens, because he always gave people, like, really loaded names. And so when you hear that word Turpin, does your brain go anywhere?
Turpin?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe turpentine, but
that's what I thought too, right? So, like, I was like, why do I know that word? It feels like I was thinking about cleaning with turpentine, like bleaching yourself clean or, like, making it really sharp. But
I remember. Oh, that just brings back memories. I think it was my third year teaching this. A student accidentally read her name out loud. She's like, wait, I was reading this wrong the whole time. I thought her name was Mrs. Turnip. And because of her shape, it made sense.
Yeah. 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 It's funny because Flannery O'Connor will do that thing where she'll name characters and describe them like vegetables. She has, in A Good Man Is Hard to Find, she says the mother's face is round and broad like a cabbage. And she says in, I think in Good Country People, she describes the mother as if she was shaped like a turnip. So I think you're not that kid, even though they were wrong, is in fact not very wrong.
Yeah. How
about
that?
It's interesting. But when I was thinking about turpin, I was thinking about turpentine, but I was doing some Googling because I prepare for this podcast, right? And what I found is that word turpitude, or that the word turpid. And I was like, oh yeah, that's not too far from turnip and turnip. But, you know, whatever it's like that. But it's the word turpid comes from the word meaning foul, base, wicked, or morally depraved. And I was like, oh, that's not accidental. She totally did that on purpose.
Oh, that's so straight.
And they're in a doctor's office, and you said that was funny because now we were thinking about, you know, not being in a quarantine. They're surrounded by a whole bunch of people. And in her space, she starts to stratify, like, there's the good folks, the rich folks, the poor folks, the black folks, and, like, she calls them the white trash. Like, she's pretty judgy here in this spot. Do you think that's significant for this character early?
Absolutely. We're supposed to see her as completely judgmental, and the way that we're reacting to Mrs. Turpin, that helps guide us through the story. Is that somebody that we're supposed to be sympathizing with? Is this someone that we're supposed to be reacting against? And, well, if we are sympathizing with her, is O'Connor passing judgment on us?
Yeah, that's a good call. She's like our protagonist because she's the main character. But she's not a likable protagonist. Like, we're kind of rooting almost to see bad things happen to her.
Right.
I like that first paragraph. It describes it as, she stood looming at the head of the magazine table set in the center of it. This is the doctor's office. A living demonstration that the room was inadequate and ridiculous. Like, there you go, man. Just shade thrown everywhere. And this is never, like, uttered. She's a good Southern woman, a very genteel, very kind lady. But in her head, she's sitting there, like, judging the hell out of everything, like his dirty blue romper, and, like, you know, his nose ran unchecked, like no one could ever tell him. It's just, the more I hear about this person, I feel like her name is Karen and she wants to talk to my manager, like, tell me a thing or two about how I need to get better at life.
I was just when you read, just to make a side comment connection, whatever, just when you read off that part, this reminded me of that scene from Gatsby when they're in the apartment in New York for the party.
Chapter two.
The one with the – well, it's
– with the neighbors from upstairs in the flat.
Exactly, yeah. And the room – it's something about the room and the size of the room.
Yeah. Wow, that's a whole other podcast. Yeah, you're right. It's a very 1920s thing about, like, the size and shape of things and the grandeur or the decay. And there's a little bit of decay in here too. When it talks about it, like, she's describing this room and the size of this woman who's, like, a larger than life character. And she says to Claude, who we don't know who Claude is, you sit here. Like, she pretty much just pushes this Claude character around. We don't know for a minute who Claude is. And it actually takes us a minute to find out, okay, he's bald, fine. But he's not Mr. Turpin. He's Claude. I'm thinking maybe he's an adult son. Maybe he's, like, a friend of the family, a hired hand. I don't know. And it takes you a good minute to realize who Claude is in relationship to she who gets this really fancified name, Mrs. Turpin, versus Claude. I think names are so critically important. I'm sorry, you were talking more about this doctor's office and the characters in there, and I should.
Oh, no worries. But just jumping in with as we go through, there's just so much implicit and explicit characterization for Mrs. Turpin, in that just with Claude, that he sat down as if he were accustomed to doing what she told him to. So this whoever this character is, he's used to being pushed around by this Mrs. Turpin.
Yup. And then they talk about, like, the people in the space next to him, like, there's the good kids, the bad kids, whatever it is, like, the people goofing around. If that child belonged to me, he would have some manners and move over. That's plenty of room for there for me and him and two. Like, she doesn't say this stuff, but she's thinking it. And so,
right. And I think
as
you're reading the story, if you're whether you're a student or a lifelong student, shall we say?
Yes, let's go.
It's never stop learning. I think it's so important to even though the quotation marks open up, to pay attention, is Mrs. Turpin saying this or is she thinking this? Because that's a really good guide. What is she saying out loud versus what she keeps inside her head? Because we have to keep in mind, she is a good Southern lady and she has her manners.
Yes.
But that's what's spoken aloud.
Manners is so frustrating. When you get to Flannery O'Connor, like, this comes up a lot. Like, Flannery O'Connor, I think the name of her book.
Mystery and Manners.
Mystery and Manners, right? It's
yep.
Like, there you go.
Yep.
It's like the things that we say and the things that
yes.
we think. And everybody, and, like, so this is the biggest pushback. So I was talking about, I'm going to make this podcast in honor of the 95th year celebrating the life of Flannery O'Connor. She would be 95 were she to be alive this year. I was like, it was her birthday this past week. And, like, we're recording it. I don't know when this will go live, but, like, people dismiss her or forget her or marginalize her. And they say, but her stuff's so dark. It's so graphic. It's so violent. It's so ick. What do you say to that as a critique? Because I agree, like, there's some nasty, there's some violence in all of her stories. Almost all of her stories really have a twist or a turn in there that is kind of dark. But I think that this mystery and this manners is a big part of it. Because, like, the South
Absolutely.
Is all about being proper, but, like, there's all these dark skeletons in their closet that they're not owning up to. And I think that to me is maybe why it don't know, it makes my heart beat faster.
Thoughts? Yeah, absolutely. And I guess just, yeah, thoughts on that. One thing is that perhaps the things in her literature that we would react against, you know, whether that's the grotesqueness or horrible actions done by certain characters that are just seemingly incomprehensible or just violent, that perhaps one of the reasons we react to them so much is maybe because of our assumptions about what a Christian author or a Catholic author should be. Yes. That, oh, you can be violent as long as you're this kind of author. You know, it's somebody who had, something you'd expect in a Stephen King book, for example, but yes. Not. So I think she definitely is, playing with this, genre. But also by playing with the expectations that you would expect from, I don't know, that you might build up an expectation of what kind of author you think her to be. That maybe she's making a commentary on how we encounter people based on their philosophies or their stated beliefs.
And we have not talked about this beforehand. And it makes for bad radio when everyone's on the same page. But yes, I completely agree with you. there's that lovely quote she says about like everything that comes out of the South is going to be called grotesque by a Northern reader, unless it is actually grotesque, in which case they'll call it realistic. And like, we hold her to a totally different standard than we hold people like Stephen King or Truman Capote or anybody who's like, well, but guys could talk about, blood and guts and sex and death. Like Flannery O'Connor goes there with her stories, and these characters may not verbalize those things, but they're thinking those things. And so when something bad or something nasty happens, it's like, yeah, that's part of life. Like all the dark stuff, the twisted stuff, that's a part of the human heart that largely goes unexplored in this idea. Well, that's not what a Southern woman's supposed to do. Like, I think when I read To Kill a Mockingbird, like Anne Alexandra drives me nuts as a character, because it's just like, let's sit around and let's have tea and let's have the most boring parts of the book when everyone just sits there and like says what they're expected to say. It's very like rehearsed. It's very like going to a cotillion. And the fun of that book is the dark stuff. It's the twisted stuff. It's the conversation about race and about ableism, about, equality, about gender, and like, that they hold Scout to a double standard because she's a girl. Like, it's okay if Jem breaks his arm or if, but like, God forbid that our little girl goes out and does that stuff. I think, Flannery O'Connor does a really good job of little girls who go there, who do that. I don't know. But sorry, we're talking about this scene in the doctor's office. And in there, we have characters who we are like looking at, we're judging, we're sizing up. And like, there's a cast of characters. I don't really feel that this translates well for a modern audience. There's like a bunch of old cigarettes. Like they're sitting around a doctor's office. It's kind of maybe overcrowded. I don't know. But you get a sense of like the relative financial means of the people in the space. They talk about cigarette butts in an ashtray, cotton wads with little blood spots on them. Like if you went to your doctor's office today and you saw that, you'd be mortified, would not go back. But our lady sees and sizes up these people, and nobody in the room gets a name except for Mrs. Turpin and the child of a pleasant lady who seems to be like a friend, but not a friend in the story. Do you want to maybe talk about that? Because that's not accidental.
The naming or not naming of characters?
Yeah. Like there are a bunch of like, there's basically the generic white trash. There's a whole bunch of people who are generic white trash, and that's what she calls them.
Right. Well, I remember in this, in the story when I would study it with my sophomores, one thing that I would have them do is is rank the people in the room according to how Mrs. Turpin would rank them.
Oh my god! oh my god!
and because that's what Mrs. Turpin's doing, she's comparing them to each other. It's interesting to read the story. It's like, okay, who in the room does she think the least of, based on her descriptions? So that's just one thing there. But also just naming people by, different physical features. So like, the nurse who pops in, with the highest stack of yellow hair Mrs. Turpin had ever seen.
Yeah, there you
just
go.
Comments like that. And but the interesting thing is,
I use it a million times a day.
I think we do that ourselves when we're in a public space or when we're surrounded by people we don't know and we're, looking around and observing them. In our heads, or maybe to the person we're sitting with, we might say, oh, the person, with the purple headphones or things like that. So if we don't know names, we're going to identify people by, something physical that sticks out about them.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's
right.
If you're talking about their headphone color, that's one thing. If you're talking about like their human worth, it's quite something else.
Yes.
I while we're talking about like, I'm realizing how many female authors are going to be making this podcast. This is an amazing thing. I'm already excited. But like, there's an Ani DiFranco song that it's called 32 Flavors, and she says, "Being too pretty is also your doom because everyone harbors a secret hatred for the prettiest girl in the room." And it's like, when you show up, if you're sizing that person up and you're like, oh, they're uglier than me, then you're ranking yourself as better than them. And if you think, oh God, she's so much prettier than me, then you're kind of like hating them and like resenting that. And when Miss Turpin is doing that, going through her head, she's like sizing up the people around her, sizing up. She gets a little into a seat, sees a little snug, and she says out loud, like, oh, I wish I could reduce. Like, I wish I could lose a few pounds. Just so that people who are stylish will tell her, oh, no, you're not fat. Like, she's fishing for compliments from people
who are
the better half. Like, and she talks about her weight and things like that. And when she describes the girl, the college-educated girl, she describes her as, quote, a fat girl of 18 or 19 reading a book called Human Development. And it's interesting about that, too. Do you want to talk about this girl she describes as, she has bad acne, a face with blue with acne. How pitiful it is to have a face like that at that age. She herself was fat, but she always had at least good skin. She was 47 years old. Not a wrinkle on her face, except for around her eyes from laughing too much. BS. thoughts. I'm trying to keep it clean for
sure. So again, with Mrs. Turpin, as she goes through, she's not only comparing characters to each other, but also comparing herself to those characters. It's like, how am I better than this person? Or, oh, she's got, man, she has that acne. I'm so glad that I have good skin. And at the same time, I think so. This girl of this college age girl with the acne face is sitting next to the stylish lady. So we could gather that they're perhaps related.
She's good stuff. Perhaps. She's good. She's good people, right?
Right. And just previously, the Mrs. Turpin and the stylish lady had this interaction. Oh, you're not fat. You're not fat. And the stylish lady saying, as long as you have a good disposition, it doesn't matter what size you are. You can't be at a good disposition. And then when Mrs. Turpin starts interacting with this girl, right, she tries to smile at her as if, you know, out of pity for her blue acne face.
Oh, it's abundantly
clear. But then the girl scowls back.
Yes.
And so there it is. Well, only is she this girl fat, but she has a bad disposition.
Bad disposition, which is like two strikes, right? Like
exactly. You
know, there's a line later, and it said, "All at once, the ugly girl turned her lips inside out again. Her eyes were fixed like two drills on Miss Turpin. There was no mistaking. There was something urgent about them." So, like, okay, she's giving her the stink eye, and along the way, this college-educated fatty. No offense, it's just using Flannery O'Connor's language.
Exactly.
With her bad skin and like stink eye and me. Well, I'm just trying to be a good person. Ultimately, it doesn't go well between the two of them. Without a word exchanged, this gal gets really upset and like does maybe not the unthinkable, but certainly the unexpected here. And we find out along the way, while this woman is sitting there and judging the white trash and the white trash all around it, they're actually not the biggest threat to her. It's this college-educated girl reading Human Development who ultimately gets really upset, this ugly girl, and does something that's really, like I said, unexpected. Is that about right here?
Absolutely.
And I think that's interesting because she doesn't do it up first, but she does it after Miss Turpin opens her, fat mouth and says some language that seems to be about both Jesus and about race. She says you can either use the N-word or white trash. What would you rather be? Like, she's using language in her head and like you can see her like processing, well, I'm better than them because at least I'm not poor or at least I'm not black. And back and forth and back and forth they go. And then Mr. Turpin Claude gets in on the act too and makes a racist joke. And that's enough. That's enough to make this gal who she's being stared at like not happy. It says that this woman lets out a look at her. And, you know, the mom is saying, well, of course, we understood that we have to have certain things before we know certain things. Like, it's okay to make fun of black people. It's okay to make fun of people who are poor. But then the college age girl loses it. And it doesn't go well. So, like, can we talk about this big plot twist moment of what happens in this? I guess we'll call it the climax. Maybe not the climax, but it certainly is. Sorry, we're all listening on a PDF. This is hard in a time of coronavirus. This is like
a podcast
in a time of corona. It's just different.
I'm wanting my physical books here.
No, I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay. We're making it work.
I think the plot twist actually shows up.
It's later. It's later. There's a whole build here.
Yeah.
But one thing, just with what you were saying, as this is building, the comments about race and Jesus and such like that, I think it's one thing that is just fascinating. You think of you know, how people get themselves to sleep at night. They count sheep or whatever like that.
Yeah.
But what it says that Mrs. Turpin occupies herself with at night sometimes is thinking that if Jesus had given her the option of being white trash,
ooh,
or
the N-word,
as she says, she would have chosen. She would have. Well, she would have actually said.
She would be black, but make me a good one.
Exactly. Right? And so, just what conversations about race is that opening up? And in our world today, is that what we would expect? So I think that's that. Just when I remember reading this, and when my students would get to that point, they're like, "Wait, really? That's like, how can she?" They're just so, you know, such strong reactions to that. I'm just grappling with this. How is she even thinking about that? And why is she talking to God about that? Like, that's horrible.
Yeah. It is, but like, this is, I mean, like, there's so much more to this too. And we can talk about, like, she's both classist and racist, and she's using like the N-word here. Like, it's much like Mark Twain. The use of the N-word is not because the author themselves is in fact racist. What they're doing is putting a comment forth that is coming out of the brain or the mouth or the mind of a character, and the character is almost becoming like a caricature of a type of the South or a type of a person or type of a Christian. And that idea of that very condescending, like, oh, bless their heart, very Southern type, but in fact they're sitting there and they're like, oh wait, we have a very rich history in the South of owning human beings and like treating people like subhumans, mm-hmm. and not, you know, like saying one thing to be, you know, inspired by Jesus, but then doing the exact opposite in our behaviors. And I think that like counting your sheep and counting your blessings when you go to bed, she's not being thankful for all the things that she has. She's saying, well, thank God I'm not that thing. Thank God I'm not that one. Thank God I'm better than
right.
That.
Like, different sort of counting blessings.
She's made like a caravan into heaven and said, well, thank God I'm not in the back of the line.
Mm-hmm.
Major spoiler. She might be. so yeah, I mean, like, eventually it makes this gal get really upset, and we come to learn about, you know, like, oh, there's nothing to, you know, like these kids, what are you here for? Oh, they're just eating, you know, and no, they're not eating the right stuff. You know, I can't get them to feel any better. Look, I can't get nothing on those two, but Coca-Cola and candy. Like, that's all they're going to try to get. They're fat kids, blah, 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 blah. Gives them that acne, blah, 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 blah. And then the girl just gets tired at a certain point of looking at this woman just running her mouth. Like, and maybe you've been there. I've been in lines in like amusement parks where I'm just like waiting and like hanging out with my family or friends. And then the people around me, I'm just like, I'm hearing that insipid conversation, that buzz in the background. And I just get really angry. And I'm like, they haven't done a thing to me, but I just don't like hearing their sound and their voice. So I kind of give the look, right?
Mm.
So it gets to that spot where they do exchange a look, and the girl gets really, I mean, like, she gets testy and says something to Miss Turpin. And that really does kind of kick us into the next phase of our story.
Right. Yeah. And as we're going through, one thing that, just reading this story again, something that I'm picking up on that, like, important detail that was like, oh, this becomes significant. But just the, throughout how people are being characterized, the girl, this ugly girl, is eventually characterized in ways that it's almost like, in non-human ways, like she's some sort of machine or animal or just non-human thing. So
yeah,
like that her eyes seemed lit all of a sudden with a peculiar light, an unnatural light, like night road signs give. So just this light and that stare that eventually becomes this frustration and this
like an
reaction.
Animal, like a lashing out, like a rat in a cage being
right,
poked too many times.
Right.
And then when she says, it's interesting though, because talk about names, like they say on farms, and I learned this one from people who are family members, who I grew up in a very rural area in New Jersey. They said, like, if you own chickens on your farm and you have to like sell chickens, slaughter chickens, don't name chickens. Like, don't name the chickens because you don't want to humanize them. Like, they're just produce, that are just livestock, literally. And that's important here because later in the story we see, like, she interacts with black characters. They don't get names. Like, to this woman who's not a racist, but kind of a racist, not a slave owner, but definitely a landowner, black people don't have names. White trash don't have names. They're like less than. They're just objects to be moved around. The one character in this story who gets a name aside from Mrs. Turpin and Claude is this girl, this college-age girl with the blue acneed face. And that color blue is important too, because we come to learn that the girl says, you know, like when she doesn't answer the question, the mom says, the lady asked you a question, Mary Grace. And she says, I have ears. Like, Mary Grace can't be an accident that this girl is named Mary Grace.
Oh, no.
Yes? Mary Grace with a blue face. Mary Grace with the blue eyes. Mary Grace, you know, who comes from a place outside of this area and is in some ways attempting to reveal to this woman her blindness. Is that overstated or is that accurate? Because she's not of this world. And I mean, like, of this world of this Southern Gothic space. She feels like an outsider, like an alien, like an import, like a robot. Or
right.
Something from the world outside.
Right. And I think that's just thinking to some of the other characters that we see in Flannery O'Connor's short stories, that sometimes characters who are college educated or who leave town to seek something outside of their town, and they come back and they feel this this lack of community or this separation from the community or like outsiders, as you said. So I'm wondering if that's something that's going on here.
I think you're right. Did you have a chance to ever read Ghost Out of Watchmen, by the way?
Yes, I did.
Okay, because like it has that same sort of plot twist. Turns out Atticus Finch may be a racist. I'm not clear on that. But our main character, comes back from college and sees the right. world of where she grew up from outside of that. And mm-hmm. I think that's a very, and again, I'm not from the South, but I understand the idea of leaving home. It's like that joke about the Irish boomerang. It is thrown away from home and never returns, but it sings a bunch of sad songs about it, right? Like, there's this expat thing when you leave where you came from, or like Bruce Springsteen, you want to get out of your mm-hmm. one horse town. And I think that that's a big undercurrent here, because what they're saying without saying it is like, this feels very fetid, very poisoned, very toxic, very incestuous in a way. And we need to kind of go away from that in order to recognize how broken or how polluted that space really is, to kind of get a fresh set of eyes on it.
Right.
Is that maybe accurate? And I think that there's a line here too that says the girl looked up as if she would like to hurl them all through the plate glass window. Like, there's a mounting sense of violence that's coming here. Going.
Right.
And ultimately it does go. I mean, it goes exactly as it needs to. Were you caught by surprise? And we can talk about the spoilers now, when bad stuff happens at this part of our story.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I was like, she did what?
Right. So I mean, like, especially out of nowhere. You
know, yeah, especially because
like, girl just takes a book and throws it at this lady full force and then jumps on her and starts to strangle her.
Yeah. And I think the buildup here where the girl is just, you know, she's staring and she hasn't said anything. And then she starts making she has this ugly animalistic face and then a loud, ugly noise through her teeth. And then her face is turning purple. It's really interesting to just go back through the story and just read the parts that refer to the girl and see that buildup of action and reaction. Anyway, so the girl's face is turning purple, and then the last straw, right? Mrs. Turpin saying, if it's one thing I am, it's grateful. When I think of who all I could have been besides myself and what all I got, a little of everything and a good disposition besides, I just feel like shouting, thank you, Jesus, for making everything the way it is. Praise, right? Praise the Lord. Oh, thank you, Jesus. Thank you. Thank you, she cried aloud. The book struck her directly over her left eye. It's just like, boom.
Boom.
Right there in the middle of the praise session. It's right. Well, so good. It's nowhere.
It is so good. And it's something that Flannery O'Connor does story after story after story. In his podcast, we're talking about it a lot. But like, it's when somebody who is sacrilegious or is like a hypocrite mm-hmm. has the audacity to bring Jesus's name forward. Mm. That's where things get really bad for that person. It's like, you have a lot of nerve saying that word, good sir, good woman. And it's when they say it, it's almost like a cuss word or like a how dare you.
Yeah, it's taking it in
that's
vain.
The thing. Oh my God, yeah. Like literally, oh my God. Yeah. And it's that which takes this blue Mary Grace, spoiler, Mary Grace, right? Like, and makes her just launch out at full volume. And of course, what she's doing is not just hitting her in the eye, which is leading this idea of like making they talk about a protuberance over her eyebrow, like the ability to see is now compromised. But in fact, it's like giving her clear sight, and we'll talk about the revelation in the future. But also like that she lunges for her throat mm-hmm. and digs her thumbnails in so deep it leaves like two half moons, like in the woman's voice.
Right.
Almost as if like she's trying to stop her from having the ability to speak those words. And in a violent encounter, what she's doing is offering this woman a moment of, wait for it, Mary Grace.
We shall see.
I guess that's fair. So we're at the midpoint of the story, and I think this is actually a good place to like, we'll just put a pause in the podcast. We'll take like two more minutes and wrap up here and not leave the doctor's office. But like a plot twist as we leave forward here, the girl's rolling around. They have to sedate her. They stab her. So they say, wow, she's a lunatic. Let's cart her off to the asylum. But they say as she's being wheeled away, she says something with like a haunting line in advance, like a hint of what's to come. But they say the girl's eyes stop rolling, and they seemed a much lighter blue than they ever had before, as if a door that had been tightly closed behind them was now open to admit light and air. So she has something like a revelation herself, the girl does, that she leaves this woman with, and like this plot twist as we move forward. I guess without giving away the back half, we'll do this another podcast because there's just too much good stuff here. What do you make of this, like, cliffhanger at the midpoint of the story? Because the story could end here, but it doesn't.
Sure.
Because our hero or our protagonist hasn't really learned her lesson yet. What do you make of it here as we kind of, like, I guess, leave folks with bated breath at the midpoint?
And for our stopping point, are we taking the attack or after Mary Grace speaks to her?
I think let's let her be pulled away with her final parting shot, because that'll leave it like, what the hell do we do with that mention for the next part?
Okay, so Mary Grace delivers the line, and we
yeah,
in there.
Yeah, okay. Because she has like a line in there.
Exactly.
Sort of like the,
yep. So
put the knife.
So and again, this is so cool because one of the reasons I love rereading is because you always pick up on new things. So I'm focusing this time on Mary Grace's eyes. The girl's eyes stopped rolling and focused on her. They seemed a much lighter blue than before, as if a door that had been tightly closed behind them was now open to admit light and air. So earlier we had her eyes as signposts, road signs, and now they're mm-hmm. this door that's opening. Then Mrs. Turpin's head cleared and her power of motion returned. So she's having this, she's being drawn in somehow. And looks directly into the fierce, brilliant eyes. There is no doubt in her mind that the girl did know her in some intense and personal way beyond time and place and condition. And how we think, as readers, how is that possible? She's never met the girl. So what's happening here? Mm-hmm. And then Mrs. Turpin says to Mary Grace, "What you got to say to me?" she asked hoarsely and held her breath, waiting as for a revelation. The girl raised her head, her gaze locked with Mrs. Turpin's.
And she gives us a line where she tells her exactly. Now, we're going to set this up and we're going to let this be our cliffhanger for the next part. But, like, there's that Bill Engvall sketch. Like, he's that blue-collar comedy guy. He's like, blah, 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 here's your sign. You ask for a sign. Here's your sign. Here you go. Like, the woman is asking for a sign from Jesus. Do you want a sign? You're going to get one. Like, the girl who she treats like a robot or a blue-faced freak is, like, signposts now opening a door. And I'm going to give you the honors. You can go ahead and deliver the big line. We'll leave it as a cliffhanger to finish out.
Great. Right. The girl raised her head, her gaze locked with Mrs. Turpin's. "Go back to hell where you came from, you old warthog," she whispered. Her voice was low but clear. Her eyes burned for a moment as if she saw with pleasure that her message had struck its target.
I'm so in for what happens next. Oof. This is a great place to finish.
Oh, yes.
We'll take a breath here. This is definitely a two-parter, so tune in next time. We're going to talk more about Revelation for Flannery O'Connor. This is Victoria. This is John. Do you have like a one-word summary of what they should expect or what your impressions have been of this part of the story so far? I mean, like, I know there's no right or wrong answers, but like, I'm shook and I'm so in for where it
is. What can I come up with? So you're asking for a one-word recap or one-word preview?
One-word recap or precap. I'm leaving it wide open, right? So you can go either way with it.
Gotcha.
There's no wrong answers. I'm like, there's so much to unpack. I'm understanding very quickly that these podcasts cannot in any way be a half hour. They absolutely have to be pieces and parts taken slowly.
Like, goodness,
like
I know.
A fine wine. You know, like, let's really, really enjoyed slowly.
Let's say purging.
Purging. I'm in. Let's go. All right. So we'll tune in another time, and I guess we'll set up another Skype, and we'll talk about that stuff offline. But you're in to talk about the second half of the story with
me? Oh, absolutely. Yeah. This is great.
Amazing.
Also, what's really fun, where we left off, that's where I would have my students stop. I would.
Are you kidding
me? Well, because the PDF ends there. It would end at that page, so I would only give them half of it.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah.
And then if it's good, like it makes you want to come back.
Exactly.
For more. We'll talk about the second half of the story in our next podcast. We want to thank you guys again for tuning in. This is Victoria. This is John. We'll see you next time with more Everything That Rises. Flannery O'Connor podcast. Thanks again. If you like what you're hearing, leave a comment, subscribe, let other people know about it. It's a great way to get the podcast in the hands of other folks. And if you have ideas for the future, shoot me a message on the Twitter machine at @MeehanEDU. We'll be back with more next time. Thanks again.